Florian, you have audio.
Hey everybody.
Hi.
It's late. Sorry, I just got in. I'm on a long bike ride and I got home late.
Hey mate, will you grab another?
Okay. Okay, so who's on? Chuck, you're on. Okay, that's good. So I'm like in somebody's backyard in the middle of Iowa on this bike ride, and I can't guarantee that I'm gonna have, you've got an extender to make it so that I can be on this meeting. And I'm not 100% sure that it's gonna play the video, but it looks like Megan is also having trouble. So.
No, I do have the video here to play.
The video is, I sent the video to Megan.
I've got it too.
In an email early. You have it too, okay. So it would probably be safer for, who else? I think I copied Megan and Doug and, right? Didn't I copy Megan, Doug's message? Is that true?
I think, but I plan on playing the video.
You can or cannot play the video?
I can play the video and I plan to.
Oh, you plan to, okay, good. Sorry, there's music in the background. There's, my speaker is terrible, so I've got no guarantees what will happen. I saw something, Chuck, that said if you play the video, you can't do anything else.
Right.
Correct?
Right.
All right. Well, should I try to play it in the hopes that it plays from my side better than it plays from your side?
No, I can kind of tell that your signal isn't great.
Okay. Doug, are you on? Could you play the video? Did you get that link?
I did not get that link.
All right. Let me see if I could forward you the link right now, because if you could play the.
What I was doing, I was just getting ready to also connect via my phone so that I'd have my phone as a backup, you know,
okay.
On my computer, I can use the phone.
Yeah, okay. Jeff can do all it right, because I'm actually on the road right at the moment. So,
okay. Unless, I mean, I can try.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think it'll
go. I will try.
You're just a little bit broken up and your video isn't smooth at all.
Okay. All right, so we'll just count on Chuck doing it, and I'm sorry for being out in the middle of nowhere, and yeah, this is no fun. Anyway, but I did ride my bike across Iowa today. Yesterday, I met the Iowa Pork Queen, and today I saw a brass band in a backyard, and what else did I do today? All kinds of silliness, but my riding partner wasn't very fast, and I felt bad leaving him, so I stayed with him, and that meant that I just got home at 6:30 and needed a shower. And I'll probably have somebody bring me some food while I'm here because I'm hungry. Anyway, I could, I guess, in the meantime, introduce our speaker. She's not on yet, so I'll have to introduce her again later. Okay, hang on. Someone's chatting. I got to open the chat. I'm sorry. I'm totally discombobulated. I've seen it. Maybe I will post. We all drop the call and all join again at 8:30. What? Let me post the YouTube link. We all drop the call. The movie is only 20 minutes long.
Right.
Mike Cogley. So we'll just play that right at the very beginning. And the speaker can't come until, I think she said
7:45 Central Time.
7:45 Central Time. Okay, so we're going to watch the movie for 20 minutes. Then we're going to talk about it for whatever's left, 20 minutes or so. And then our speaker will join us after she, I can't remember, puts her kids to bed or something. Okay, Rebecca. Okay, so open a link for the video. Oh my goodness, my shoulders hurt. Okay, so Chuck is playing the video, so I don't have to play the video. All right. I have to find is the speaker's introductory information, which is, I get too many emails. That is the answer. And also I don't label my emails well enough to find them later. Oh, there we go. Okay. Yes, it is. Okay. Can you guys hear me okay that I could introduce our speaker now just in case something bad happens?
Yes, we're still a few minutes early.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'll wait till we start then. And if my riding partner doesn't show up with food for me by 7, I might briefly disappear while the movie's playing and go find some food, or at least tell him that I need some food. Hey, Vicky. Hey, I have been in and out of town like way too much. I spent like 9 days in Wichita, and then I spent 3 days in visiting Megan in Memphis, and now I'm on a bike ride, so I've not had a chance. Can you, Vicky, put your new, I heard you got a new address. Vicky. Can you put your either email me your new address or put it in the chat or something so that I can get you your award? Oh, and Chuck, it looks like we can only direct message members. Could you change it again so that people can message everybody? Pretty please.
Yeah.
Hi, Eric. Bossy, I've never met you. You want to introduce yourself in 1 minute if I unmute you? Can you unmute yourself? And then I don't know how to fix it. I don't know how to change you into unmuted. You're muted, Bossy. Can you unmute yourself?
No, you'll have to unmute or...
But when I click this button, all I have a choice of is pin. That's the only option I have.
Are you on a phone? Are you on your phone, Anne? Oh, I think we lost Anne.
Uh-oh.
Oh, there you are. Are you on a phone or a computer?
I'm on a computer. I'll stop my video maybe and see if that frees me up. But I still don't have any way to unmute Abasi. So I can't really do that. And now it's 7. So come back next time.
All right. Yeah. So now the messaging is enabled for everyone.
Thank you. Okay. How many minutes after do we like to wait, Chuck?
We've got 36 and we've got almost 70 signed up.
Okay. So a little bit longer.
Yeah. We're about half the people are here.
Okay.
Two or three more minutes.
Any chance you could unmute people and let them introduce themselves while we wait for the other 36 people?
Well, people need to raise their hand and then I can find them and unmute them.
Okay. Well, I just pick people whose faces I can see that I've never talked to before. But you didn't move? Okay. I still don't have your stand up. Chuck told me you moved. Chuck.
Yeah.
Abasi, raise your hand so Chuck can find you and unmute you. Raise your hand means go to the bottom and there's a button that says reactions. So click on reactions and then click raise hand, Abasi. Way at the bottom of your screen, there should be chest. Nice.
Okay, go ahead.
Hello. I got to take a whole minute?
Take whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, I've been lurking in the background for a while. I'm not exactly new.
Oh, you're new to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think I talked to you one time before. Maybe like a year ago, New York City.
Oh, fun.
Actually, Bronx, New York.
Cool. All right.
I even texted Keith.
All right. Next person. I think we've heard from Davis before. 8:05 time to roll. So Bill Dobbs says time to roll.
Down by Mel.
Yeah.
Let's play the video. I think it's time. Because, if nobody.
Mel and him went to school. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I didn't know that until a few weeks ago.
I knew that.
Everybody
mute yourself if you're...
Yeah, everyone needs to mute themselves, and the video will start in a moment.
Year-old swimming star Brock Turner.
The 19-year-old former high school All-American swimmer.
The star swimmer at Stanford University.
Contender for the Olympics.
Raping an unconscious woman.
Intoxicated an unconscious woman.
Passed out behind a dumpster.
Drunk behind a Stanford dumpster.
Your Honor, if it is all right, I would like to address the defendant directly. You don't know me, but you've been inside me, and that's why we're here today.
The victim made headlines by releasing a heart-wrenching letter detailing the rape and its aftermath.
Has gotten over 15 million views on BuzzFeed alone.
You don't know me, but you've been inside me.
And that's why we're here today.
I was found unconscious with my hair disheveled, long necklace wrapped around my neck.
My bare skin and head had been rubbing against the ground behind a dumpster while an erect freshman was humping my half-naked, unconscious body.
I read that according to him, I liked it.
Your damage was concrete, stripped of titles, degrees, enrollment. My damage was internal, unseen.
I kept thinking to myself, the court system doesn't deserve her.
Even if you win the battle of proving the case in court, you still have to convince a judge that a stiff prison sentence is appropriate.
Turner faced up to 14 years in prison, and he got 6 months.
It's a slap on the wrist for a privileged white sexual offender at an elite university.
My first response was, wow, that doesn't sound right. That must be white privilege going on here.
Because of good behavior in prison, Turner was released this morning after just 3 months behind bars.
We have got to fight for a world without rape. It's time to take a stand. What has happened here is unacceptable.
There's new pressure tonight aimed at removing that California judge.
Sir.
Aaron Persky is coming under fire.
Activists have targeted Judge Persky through a recall election.
We need judges who understand sexual assault and domestic violence. Judge Persky does not.
People widely recognize that women who have been victimized by men have not received justice.
People have just had enough. They've had enough of women being marginalized.
The numbers are in. 62% of the voters recalling Judge Persky.
Persky is the first California judge recalled since 1932 and what was also viewed as one of the first electoral tests of the Me Too movement.
When a fire is started, and I think of this, the anger over this case as a kind of fire, a lot of things are going to get burned. Before I became district attorney, I was a deputy district attorney for 15 years. One of the concepts within justice is holding someone accountable for what they have done.
Frustrated prosecutors say this isn't justice.
I had hoped for more time. We fought for more time. The victim deserved more time. I felt that I had failed Chanel. I disagreed with the sentence, and I told Judge Persky that. A lot of the campus sexual assault cases had been boiling over and may have not gone the way that the public wanted. So a lot of people were surprised that I opposed the recall.
I thought the recall was wrong. I can very strongly support women's rights and work vigorously to uphold the dignity of women. And I can support the independence of judges. The judge in this case had the legal right to make the decision that he made. I think that it was the wrong decision, but the law allowed him to make that decision. What if that judge is deciding whether these abortion regulations are lawful? And the judge is in a place where a lot of people don't like abortion. Do you want the judge to say, I'm living in Kansas, and so I know what people here think, so I'm gonna do what they want? You want the judge to follow the law.
Judge Persky was fair in his rulings during trial, and we looked to whether we could appeal the sentence. But we realized quickly that the sentence was legal. The judge had the discretion to sentence that way. The probation department recommended it. If we were to recall every judge we disagree with, we would have no judges.
Judging is the best job in the world and the worst job in the world. All of the drama of the human experience is played out in a courtroom.
These are photos when I started judging in 1982. And this was a big day, and there'd never been a black woman in Northern California ever.
I consider myself a feminist. And feminism to me means I am aware of and care about issues that impact women.
Persky celebrated as a win for girls and women was no such thing.
When I found out who the judge was, Aaron Persky, I began reading transcripts, the probation report, and that's when I said, wait a minute, put the brakes on here. The community, the public, the media, it's being misled. And those of us who know this need to speak out.
I'm Jeff Rosen, the district attorney of Santa Clara County. My office prosecutes sexual assault.
I've sentenced people convicted of sexual assault.
Vote no recall of Judge Persky.
Judge Persky's bias is a threat to the rule of law.
The idea of racial bias.
Laws against sexual violence mean nothing if the judges who enforce them are biased like Judge Persky.
There was an effort to say, no, this wasn't a one-off. This is a pattern with him.
So they cherry-picked five cases out of the hundreds and hundreds of cases he heard over 10 years.
Those cases were all plea bargains.
These are situations where the prosecution and the defense reached an agreement on the sentence. I think those are much different than the kind of case we had with Brock Turner.
The judge, the role we play, we get presented the plea bargain. And if the plea bargain's not violative of the law, we approve the plea bargains. Now, sometimes judges bust a plea, but it rarely happens because it's a deal.
The Guardian, they do this big story. It says Raul Ramirez to be sentenced to 3 years in prison for a case with similarities to the Stanford sexual assault case for which Brock Turner will serve only 6 months. So right off the top, Judge Persky didn't sentence Raul Ramirez.
Ramirez was a plea bargain. Judge Persky was not the judge who accepted the plea bargain, and he was not the sentencing judge. But to the recall people, it didn't matter.
Judge Persky has shown a clear bias in favor of men of privilege, in favor of people who abuse women, rape women, and we're asking that the Commission on Judicial Performance take action to remove Judge Persky.
The Commission on Judicial Performance, the body that disciplines judges if they misbehave, if they engage in misconduct, did a thorough investigation into Judge Persky, into his track record, into the 5 cases alleged by the recall people to show bias, as well as his handling of the Brock Turner case.
The Commission on Judicial Performance cleared him of wrongdoing and found no clear evidence of bias or misconduct with his ruling.
There was no bias. It wasn't even a close case.
I absolutely think that white privilege informed the Brock Turner case, but in ways that are complicated. The sentencing guidelines recognize that he was a college student that people saw with potential, with no record. And this stands in contrast to how the system would see a 19-year-old black kid from a poor neighborhood who's a defendant. Increasing sentencing, broadening the definitions of crimes, prosecuting more people, we all have this imagination that it will get at the powerful, privileged criminal offenders. But criminal law doesn't equalize the world. Criminal law does the opposite. Criminal law exacerbates inequality.
Hi, my name is Aya Gruber. I am a professor at the University of Colorado Law School. And I really want to explore the role that the feminist movement has played in our current state of racialized mass incarceration.
This feminist sensibility often has translated into tough on crime laws. And I've heard this a lot from feminists, right? We can be even prison abolitionists everywhere else, but not for sexual violence. That they don't have a general pro tough on crime community value, but they have a general pro tough on sex crime community value.
He is an elected judge, and he needs to be responsive to community values. And he has to both understand where the community is with respect to sexual assault and the need to protect our daughters while they're in college.
Judges, for years, have already been reflecting those community values. But I think it's gotten to the point in the United States where accountability means rotting in jail.
Our norm is prison. That's what's been imposed on us as communities of color. I think about my community's values, values of rehabilitation, and that incarceration in the prisons and the jails are not the only solutions to it. As a participatory defense organizer at DBUG, I and a lot of other people support families who are facing the criminal or juvenile or immigration systems. And we walk families through that system to impact the outcomes of their cases and transform the landscape of power in the courts.
How long has he been in there?
15 years.
Has he thought about the community?
Yeah.
I opposed the recall because I felt that it was a misguided solution. The recall equated accountability with long sentences and increase in mass incarceration. The way that the families at DBUG talked about the recall versus the way that maybe the legal community and politicians talked about recall were two different conversations altogether.
judges in California and beyond are concerned about getting perskied.
As soon as the recall was announced, an empirical study found that sentences in California immediately increased by 30%.
And the effect wasn't on the next Brock Turner. It was on the young people of color that come in through our doors at Debug.
Embedded within the American criminal legal system is a whole cascade of biases, starting from where the police are deployed, to which cases the prosecutors will take, to who gets convicted or is overcharged to plea, to the amount of sentencing they get. Long sentences disproportionately affect people who are nothing like Brock Turner.
The people who suffer the most are low-income and people of color.
We've seen judges stare families down in the face and say, I'm going to take your loved one away from you. Those are the kind of judges who should be questioned, like who use incarceration as the first and only resort. Mass incarceration separates families. Our homes, our streets, our neighborhoods, our schools are drained of parents, of children, of grandparents who should be together with families. Instead, they have to form a relationship behind a glass.
There is this basic moral instinct that somebody who does wrong should have consequences for that.
Former Stanford swimmer Brock Turner was sentenced to just 6 months in jail.
Serving just half his jail term.
3 months of a 6-month sentence.
I've got bad dye jobs that last longer than 3 months.
That is the type of sentence you get for a sack of weed, for raping someone. It's another pass that they're giving him.
The media uniformly covered this as a case of underpunishment, as a slap on the wrist. Brock Turner was convicted of felony sexual assault. He was sent to jail. He was placed on a registry.
He has to register as a sex offender for the rest of his life. He is restricted in where he can live, work, with whom he can associate.
If you don't know somebody who's been on a registry, if you have no relation to that, then you might imagine that this is nothing.
There's no one more vocal in defense of Chanel than I am, but the recall is not the right way to protect future victims of sexual assault and prevent another Brock Turner from happening.
We need to shift our frame in thinking about how to deal not just even with violence against women, but all kinds of violences, dysfunction, social problems.
The energy and the kind of anger that really came through in the recall was to quench the public's thirst for punishment and for vengeance. Do we want a legal system that does that? Hell no. If we look historically, it was people of color and low-income people who got slammed in the courts. As a feminist, that's not what I think the feminist movement should be about.
It wasn't that Brock Turner didn't deserve the kind of careful analysis that the judge gave him. It's that everyone does.
What can we do?
Stand up, fight back!
What can we do? Stand up, fight back!
This assembly is unlawful.
You are ordered.
Today we have a real opening because of the tireless work of racial justice, grassroots advocates, but other forces can push back on that momentum. One of them can be when feminists who are rightly and importantly seeking sexual justice, when they valorize that system of harsh punishment, all the public work that's been done to see that system for what it is can fade. Seeking harsh sentences within our mass incarceration system is just a poor way to try to bend the moral arc towards justice.
I guess things a month into the indefinite future, and I do not have a big Rolodex. I just basically, I found, and they, would you host a show?
And your audio is cutting out pretty bad.
But I'm really interested in hearing this conversation. Citizens, all you people who are, had to step away for a minute. I did watch this, but it's been a while, and I had to step away for a minute. So basically, I'm a little informed right this. And Claire, I still don't think I get to unmute. Oh, I do. Claire, I guess.
Yes, but I can't.
And hang on.
There I am. Hi.
Right. So go ahead, Claire. And we have until 7:45 before the author joins us. So if we're going to say anything, I'm kind of, you got to get it out now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's funny because, I sort of cursorily looked at this film, but I hadn't really properly looked at it until now. I am a film and television agent, and my background is in documentaries in Britain. And I was involved in a BBC 1995 documentary when the three strikes laws were introduced and victims' impact statements were introduced. And we made it in California. So I'm pretty familiar with a lot of this. I think my biggest concern here is that the film is obviously a cause film, and it feels a little bit like it's a cover your ass film for, I don't know how you pronounce the name, Kinierski and Jeff Rosen and LaDoris Cordell, because the recall, as I remember, there was communication about it before the victim impact statement was even read, and that Kinierski and I believe Rosen were already involved in that. So for them to say now, oh, we didn't approve of the recall, and it feels like they're backtracking on what they actually were involved in. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Oh, yeah. So
Anne is muted. Maybe she doesn't realize that.
Oh yeah, so my feeling is, and I did actually write to Rebecca Cohen and to Jeannie Suk-Gerson, after this film was promoted. I think it's very interesting that NBC picked it up, because NBC have been very much involved in the narrative on these matters. And I think what concerns me most is that these kinds of documentaries like this that don't bother to look into the actual facts of the case, the trial transcripts, the counter narratives, the freedom of information requests, are really not helping progress the narrative either for the judiciary or for activists or for feminists. And that's kind of a problem for me, that if you don't do the fact checking, then you're harming, not helping. Anyone else?
Anne, I think Anne is having technical difficulties. If someone else would like to say something, go down to reactions, which might be under the more button, and raise your hand. Okay, Gregory, go ahead.
Hello. Yeah, I'll have to, you guys can hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I'll have to apologize for Anne. She's in a small town in Iowa where the coverage is often rather spotty. So I'm Anne's partner, and she's the reason she got involved in all this. This is my first view of this, and I can see that there are numerous angles with this. I remember the case coming out, and the thing is, I think that violence against women, violence in general, is still a problem. And I think that what they're pointing to is this idea that there is a one size fits all solution to these problems, which is incarceration. And when these solutions get into the hands of our current criminal justice system, there are groups that tend to pay a asymmetrically high price for these things. I remember when I was incarcerated, I was just sitting with a friend out in the yard, and we were kind of surveying who was on the yard. And this friend of mine goes, "You know, Greg, you'll get out and you'll land back on your feet. But these guys," he's pointing to the various other guys in the yard, "he says, they have no chance." And it was a function of where they were coming from and who they were. They didn't have the advantage of coming from, you know, families with money and resources and deep pockets that, you know, could catch me when I fell. And so anyway.
All right. Next we have Mike. I'll get you unmuted. Go ahead, Mike.
How you doing? Is it me? Sometimes there's multiple mics. So it's me.
Oh, yeah.
It's on.
Yeah. It is you.
Okay. How you guys doing? I actually watched this earlier this afternoon. I watched it a couple times, actually. I found it kind of interesting how it comes from sort of multiple angles. I was hoping that maybe different people would talk about those sort of different angles tonight, kind of addressing, and I'm sure the young lady that made it will probably discuss it more in detail. But, I think the previous woman with the British accent, she raised a good point about, you know, facts. And, obviously, I don't think any of us really know the actual facts, police reports, the narratives that were taken, testimonies from witnesses, et cetera, that was all probably all kept within the court system. Maybe it is public record. I don't know. But, I think it's a very unfortunate situation for the victim. And I hope that, she's able to find peace with what occurred and everything. The situation that I have that's sort of similar to that is like, you know, I come like the previous guys, I come from a good family, sort of able to bounce back and fight things, and I'm educated, whatnot. And the sort of the plea deal that I took was, it was a little different, but I'm kind of going back to a place decades ago that has caused a lot of trauma to me. My particular victim at Will, her initial police reports were sort of, that she was the victim and whatnot. And then a second round of police reports came out where she admitted that, she caused all this stuff, and she apologized to the courts, and she had to testify about lying under oath. And so a lot of times these facts come out in the court case that allow these judges to come to these, maybe his 6 months probation or whatever his, they're in jail time or whatever it might be. A lot of that stuff probably could have had to do with the outcome of what that particular judge chose. My situation was a statutory law, and basically everyone in my situation was like, look, it happened. My situation was a high school, sort of a Romeo Juliet type situation, and Massachusetts has a statutory law with that. And so there was no scientific data that even proved that. Well, there was no rape kits, there was none of that actually even proved anything. It was just me admitting what happened, and she admitting what happened, and the rest is history, kind of. And so sometimes judges, have to, I think, take that factual information into account, make a determination. My situation is, I was actually, my plea deal, I was fortunately not supposed to be a sex offender. My judge in my state, just like what they said, the judge is to follow the law, is what one of these people said. My particular judge followed the Massachusetts law, which was they could determine and change things and plead things to different things. And I was fortunate enough to not have to register a sex offender. However, 6 years after my sentence, another state decided to supersede that judgment and illegally put me on the sex offender registry for another 7 years. And I had to fight that in court to get off the registry. So I think a lot of this, like I said, has to do with facts, has to really do with facts. And I mean, we're seeing some of these facts. I think the victim statement at the beginning was very important. It makes us realize right off the bat that this was a non-consensual woman that was passed out and someone took advantage of her. And so at the end of the day, that's a sad, it's a horrible thing. And you know, it hope that this kid never does anything like that ever again. But you know, I think like the other young lady was talking about was, you know, facts. And, you know, unfortunately, I think when people jump on the bandwagon here, a lot of people don't necessarily have facts. They have opinions or biased opinions. So that was kind of like what I sort of took out of it. I took some important notes that I thought were really good too. But I'm really interested in seeing what everyone else thinks about the situation, about the movie here.
Okay, thanks for your comment there. I'm going to move.
Okay, hang on. Can I say one quick thing before I probably lose internet again? Can you hear me?
Sure. Go ahead.
I'm very sorry if I had no idea this movie was going to be this controversial. I just basically had to fill space in all these meetings, and they sent me a little reminder they sent me like a promotional thing, and I was like, sure, that'll take up a meeting. That sounds like a great idea, especially because I then contacted the filmmaker and she said she'd be here too. And I was like, a double whammy of delightfulness. So I'm really excited to listen to your, I'm going to play this when I get home. I'm mad that I actually can't pay attention, but I'm just awful. I can barely hear you. So Greg.
Rebecca is here. So
Greg, has someone agreed to host for me?
No, but Rebecca's here now, so she can speak.
Yes. Okay. All right. I'm going to try to introduce her. I'm not certain that my introduction's going to work, but I would like to try to find it because I took the time to look it up. Okay. I don't really remember, but she's at Harvard. She teaches, she filmmakes, she's got a bunch of, she's amazing. And I can't remember. And I'm really sorry, Rebecca. I really did prepare this. And then I sent it to Megan, but then Megan also has bad internet and I'm on a bike ride all week. And so I'm sorry. All right, I'm gonna mute myself.
Great. Hi everyone, I'm Rebecca, I'm the filmmaker. I apologize, I'm coming in late. It sounds like there has been some intense conversation. I'm happy to answer questions if that's a helpful place to start, or if someone wants to brief me on some of the responses, I'd love to hear it.
Okay, and Greg has his hand up. Greg, did you have another question?
No, I think my hand is, I identify with a lot with the perpetrator. I come from a world of white privilege. I was an athlete, when elite athlete, just in a different sport, not unlike this guy. And honestly, I witnessed a lot of this stuff, and people I knew, people I grew up with, committed acts like this. This young man got caught. And the people I know that I grew up with that committed acts like this, I don't know, they're in their 50s now and looking at multi-million dollar retirements or sitting on the Supreme Court, you know. And I don't know. And I spent 4.5 years in jail for downloading pictures. But I don't know. It does give me pause to think. Violence against women, it concerns me, and I think is a very important issue. But at the same time, it just seems like it is incredibly arbitrary. And the reality is, this young man who only got 6 months in prison, let me tell you, 6 days in prison is enough to set you right after spending time in prison. And being forced to register in California, that is no easy deal. And, you know, his life it's not easy. So I'll just say that.
All right. I've got Davis. I'm going to unmute you. Oh, I can't unmute Davis. Davis, your hand is up, but it won't let me unmute you. There you go. Now you're unmuted.
I was, as the film was playing, I was waiting for it to apply to this meeting and the mission of war, and because the case didn't apply to me, the recall, that didn't apply to my situation. I kept waiting for some relevance. And then I finally heard in the middle of it when the people said that they were making the point that tougher sentences do not equal more justice. And that is when it clicked for me, because that is what rings true for, I think, those of us in here that do live on the registry, because living on the registry, if that is, for my case, that is the tougher sentence that is not equaling more justice to anybody. But I think that point got lost because we all got to, you know, you just get upset at what happened, and then you focus on the guy and it's not fencing. And then that's another issue. That does not apply here. What applies for me here is that they did make that case that, just being tougher, that doesn't help. That doesn't help the victim. Thank you.
Yeah, Davis, I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing you. I think I caught most of what you said, but maybe not everything. Yes, I think that was the argument we hoped that this film would put forward. It's a very specific and very unique case. But I think what we wanted to ask was the question that frames the film is, what does justice look like for sexual violence? And the fact that punishment is a very different thing than justice, that the media universally covered this as a case of underpunishment. Again and again and again, the media said 3 months or 6 months, the length of time he served in jail, and very rarely even mentioned that he was required to register for life. And that very few Americans who aren't on the registry or don't have a loved one on the registry understand what sort of severe punishment that actually is. So we hoped to make that argument and to make a larger critique of this idea of carceral feminism, of a brand of feminism that is tough on crime, that equates justice with long prison sentences, and to show that even though in this case, people, I think, were rightfully angry about white privilege, about the disparity in sentences that Brock Turner got versus someone who was low income or a person of color, but by recalling a judge who had a track record of sentencing leniently, what we see is it didn't work to combat white privilege, that it exacerbated existing inequalities. I think we had a pretty specific audience in mind. You know, I think we were very glad MSNBC picked up the film, because we wanted to say to those feminists who think that justice is long prison sentences, that it's not the kind of justice that you think it is. It doesn't work the way you think it is. So we hoped to be part of a conversation in a 20-minute film. I think you can ask some questions, but you can't... you can sort of set the stage for how to answer them, and then you can point to people who are doing the work. So a lot of our outreach campaign has focused on uplifting the work of restorative justice, of transformative justice, of looking to non-carceral responses, of partnering with progressive statewide coalitions around gender violence, who are looking at non-carceral responses, who see all the ways that they don't serve survivors, and to step back and ask survivors what they really want, and the range of things outside the criminal legal system that when we see punishment as a one-stop shop, when that's the only thing we offer survivors, really fails to meet their needs.
All right, I don't see any other hands up. I was going to comment a little bit. I've been on the registry for 23 years, and being on the registry is much worse punishment than jail time or prison time. I spent 2.5 years of prison time, but I would have gladly spent a lot more time in prison to avoid being on the registry. The registry, so really a sentence that's one day in jail and life on the registry, that is severe punishment. And I wish the film could have shown more of the impact of being on the registry than just, you know, the mention of, you know, restrictions and jobs, because there's so much more to it. It's really serious punishment.
Yeah. Yeah. If you guys are familiar with our other work, David Feige and I made a film called Untouchable that's much longer and much more in depth. It's 105 minutes. It was also released on Peacock and it interweaves the stories of three people who have been convicted of sex crimes with the stories of three survivors of childhood sexual abuse and gets much more into depth about the experience of being on the registry. That film reached a much smaller audience than this one did. 105 minutes is hard to program in a classroom. It's harder to program in conferences. It didn't get picked up for television broadcast. And I think we set out purposely to make a shorter film that could engage people who might not, you know, I think it was hard to get people to watch Untouchable. It was hard to get people to sign up to see a film about the registry, but something shorter that could be shared on social media, that could be embedded in newspaper, in articles, you know, I think gave us a much more powerful reach for this film. So that's part of why we decided to keep it so short.
Okay, Anne, go ahead, Anne. Nope.
Got it. There we got it. I was just going to say, I just listened to a couple of podcasts at least. I can't remember which one it was. I've been doing some, a lot of Amplified Voices and a lot of the other one that I'll think of in a minute. And they're really talking a lot. They had a lady on there who was raped, who, you know, fast forward through a lot of stuff, basically like decided she didn't really want, you know, that what happened to the guy that raped her brutally. In fact, I know a lot of people who it doesn't make them feel better. So yeah, restorative justice. If we could just convince the public that restorative justice is way more effective, gives the, oh, the other one was the one with Alexis Sardina and Alyssa Ackerman. And it's called something. I'll think of it. You know, at the end of the day, what she really wanted was to have a conversation with the person. And she recognized that the person who attacked her couldn't admit that he attacked her because he would lose too much. And she doesn't really want him to lose that much, you know? Okay, I'm done. Thank you for listening to my soapbox.
Okay, we've got three people with hands up. And I'm not sure in what order. On my screen, Marty is in the first square. So Marty, let's see if I can get you unmuted. There you go. Hello, Marty.
Okay, cool. Hey there. Thanks a lot for giving me an opportunity to ask a question here. Rebecca, every documentary filmmaker approaches his or her project with a goal in mind, or rather a message to convey. And we certainly have the idea, the message that you want to in this particular film, and also Untouchable, which I did see. It's a very interesting film. I'd like to ask, what are you hoping to achieve as the final end game from this film? What would you like to see it do eventually, perhaps for this community?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, we have a bunch of goals in mind. Films on their own don't do that much. They need to work in partnership with social movements. And so we started researching this film in 2000, when the recall happened in 2018, we started filming in 2019. But we wanted to make a film that could have a real impact and that could reach a broader audience. And it wasn't until really the racial justice uprisings of the summer of 2020 after George Floyd's murder, when it felt like the arguments we were trying to make to say, that we should imagine justice as something other than just long prison sentences, that was palatable for a much more mainstream audience. So if you guys go to our website, recallreframed.com, mm-hmm. we have an action plan that lays out some of the advocacy goals, meeting the unmet needs of survivors, and the fact that like prison and accountability often have very, very little to do with one another, and looking at different forms of accountability that survivors seek. The second is about thinking critically about sentencing reform, ending mandatory minimums, rethinking the registry in the face of clear data that shows that it is not effective at keeping us safer. The third is thinking about judicial elections. It's not just the recall that increases sentences. We actually find that judges become much more punitive immediately before they're elected. And so we have a series of articles out. We partnered with a mission-driven newsroom called The Emancipator to produce a series of articles, one that also ran in Inquest and the other in Lux magazine, which is a socialist feminist magazine. About questions related to judges and politics and sentencing and highlighting some of the work of activists who are trying to push back on these punitive approaches.
One other question, if I may. Have you considered a documentary to show how the registry is not protecting anyone, how it's inefficient, how it's basically costing so much money and it's not actually stopping people from harming? In fact, if anything, the fact that it is throwing people on the street, taking away employment, support, et cetera, that it's actually possibly creating danger. Have you considered something along those lines?
I'd encourage you all to see Untouchable. That film makes all of those arguments. We spent more than 3 years making that film and a year running the outreach campaign. So I hope that's something that lands in the world.
A short film, kind of like this one. As you said, I mean, there's a lot of people out there that just don't want to sit around for a 105-minute documentary, but certainly for this type of project.
We've made a number of short films related to Untouchable. One was on the New York Times that showed that the relationship between the registry and recidivism and the fact that courts continually get that wrong, that courts cite that that the reoffense rates are frightening and high and that the data bears out absolutely none of that. So yes, we made a series of three short films related to Untouchable. One was on the New York Times, one was on the Marshall Project and got more than 3 million views. Sorry, maybe it was just those two films. But yes, we made two short films related to those arguments.
Okay, just one final comment. Perhaps consider something where you actually show the collateral damage, where you actually have children of registrants or close family of registrants. Sorry, I'm just stuttering a little bit. How it's affecting and harming them so that people in society can understand that this is not only something that's ineffective, but it also is creating harm to a lot of innocent people.
Yeah, that's why we were so grateful to have Vicki Henry participate in Untouchable and other activists from WAR share their stories. That was something important for us to tell.
Thank you.
Oh, is it my turn?
Oh yeah, and I'm sorry, I was muted when I was talking there, so. Go ahead, Claire.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Rebecca. I am a filmmaker. My background is in documentary films, and I actually worked on a 1995 BBC documentary about victim impact statement and the three strikes laws in California. I'm glad somebody asked you earlier what your goal is in this. My concern is, I don't know if you're aware of a couple of things, but in Santa Clara County, there is this thing called the BPMP, I think it's Bank Bench Media Prosecutor or Bank Bench Media Project. And it's actually caused, I believe, one of the judges to step down because it's been uncovered by Robert Hansen in Davis Vanguard magazine and local journalist Susan Bassey, that the media and judges and a few other and prosecutors were having these private meetings before trials, and Brock Turner's one was one of them, I understand. And then in addition, there was a 2019 Freedom of Information Act drop of documents, which basically indicated that Stanford Law Professor Michelle Dorber was communicating behind the scenes behind the Brock Turner trial. And Mike Armstrong, who was Brock Turner's defense attorney, had been an attorney for Michelle Dorber's family and did not disclose that. So, and then in terms of the white privilege, yes, it's white privilege to go to Stanford University. But if you look at the value of the Brock Turner income versus Chanel Miller's income, the Chanel Miller lived in a big Palo Alto expensive multi-million dollar house versus Brock Turner. So and then Chanel Miller was personal friends with Michelle Dorbach. And it looks as though Michelle Dorbach actually created the victim impact statement that Chanel Miller read. So my concern about this documentary is it's sort of going to portray Brock Turner as this terrible person again and this white privilege, when in fact the real facts of the matter show that behind the recall of Judge Persky and behind the entire trial, there was this activism. And on the 29th of April, 2014, the department, which was the same day as the White House Not Alone white paper was introduced, the Department of Justice Department of Justice, Adam Walshat, introduced a new grant specifically for campus sex offenses. So there was an incentive to put students on the sex offender registry.
You raise a number of points. Remind me if I don't respond to all of them. I am familiar with Susan Bassey's research, and I am not persuaded by it. I believe Brock Turner was convicted by overwhelming evidence. And I believe, as the film outlines, that there was white privilege at play. Brock Turner did drugs in high school, like many of us, but because he didn't live in an over-policed community, he had no criminal record. And so he was given incentives. The sentencing guidelines give benefit to people who have no prior convictions. And if you live in a place where for smoking a joint, you get arrested, that's a very different way to go to court than if you have no previous arrests. So I stand by the fact that Brock Turner's case was a reflection of white privilege. That said, I think it's fine to argue, you know, I think it's what Charisse Domingo says, which is, it's not that Brock Turner didn't deserve an individualized sentence. He absolutely did. It's that everyone does. The issue is we shouldn't be ratcheting up Brock Turner's sentence. We should be lowering everyone else's. And that's the argument we need to be making very clearly. And that's what I hope the film does. I'm aware that some people have claimed Chanel Miller did not write her victim impact statement. I do not believe that. I have read Chanel Miller's book. I have heard her voice. I think that is absolutely her words. And if someone edited it, I think that people edit my director's statement. I get feedback on things I write all the time. It doesn't mean it's not my voice.
Did you read the trial transcript? Did you read? So you understand about the conflicts of the police, like the evidence that was missing. You understand about the license plates that were taken down but then removed. You understand that Chanel Miller's, you understand about the photographs that were put on his phone. Do you understand all of that stuff?
I have read and reviewed all that evidence. There were two independent witnesses who saw Brock Turner assaulting Chanel Miller when she was unconscious. I think that is, the jury believed that that was sufficient evidence beyond a shadow of a doubt to convict him. So I don't believe this was a wrongful conviction. And I think it is misguided for us as a movement to fixate that on that, especially in a case where the evidence is so clear. The question is, how should we respond?
There was no DNA on her. There was no DNA on her. His DNA was not on her.
I don't want to engage in an argument about the evidence. I believe the evidence is clear and overwhelming that Brock Turner was guilty of what he was accused of. And I still believe that no one, including Brock Turner, deserves a life on the registry, and that we can make those arguments without having to absolve him of actually having committed some serious harm.
Do you think that it's right that a victim impact statement should be shared with the hunting ground before it's read at sentencing?
Look, you're asking that's a complicated question. I'm not sure we should ever have victim impact statements. I think that is a complicated thing, but no, I think victims are absolutely able to tell their story publicly and should be able to argue their case in the court of public opinion as well as in a court of law. So,
my point is this, is that the victim impact statement was shared with the media before it was read in the court. And therefore, what that particular case is advocating for is that the court of public opinion should influence the sentencing. And I think that's a problem.
The opinion, it wasn't published until after the sentencing. So it wasn't that the court of public opinion.
Michelle Dorber on Wikipedia, actually, that's how I found it. She gave it to Amy Goodman, she had shared it with her friends, the filmmakers of The Hunting Ground, before the sentencing. And the issue with the filmmakers of The Hunting Ground is that they are tied to the Stanford Board of Trustees and to the White House Not Alone Task Force and to It's on Us. And so, the Hunting Ground itself is a lot of propaganda. Mattress Girl's story fell apart. Andrew Pino's story fell apart. David Lissack got rid of his own statistics, recognizing that they were flawed. So my problem is, and I'm sorry I'm angry about this, but it's tied into a lot of things. And I have daughters, by the way, I don't define myself about it, but I am a sexual survivor. So my issue is that if we as filmmakers don't go into the facts and don't raise the questions about trial by media, we are pushing a narrative that is actually interfering with the independence of the courts and the investigations. And all the research will show that Michelle Dorber was colluding, the emails are there behind the scenes with the DA, and she is an activist. And therefore, what Michelle Dorber was doing was interfering with the criminal justice system.
Claire, a simple Google can show that the victim impact statement was published, went public, and was published after Judge Persky made the sentencing judgment. So I don't know, I just don't understand. Is your argument that you believe that the victim impact statement influenced Persky, that he would have given an even more lenient sentence?
No, that's not my point. My point is that the victim impact statement was used to basically demean, it was basically made to shame Persky and Brock Turner before sentencing. And my understanding, and others know better than I do on this, but my understanding is that inquiries had been made about the recall of Judge Persky before the sentencing. So there was a plan. So it's really, so to me, the whole issue is really about, do we want an independent judiciary or do we not? And I believe that an independent judiciary is absolutely fundamental to a functioning society. And I don't want to see lobbyists inside a courtroom or behind the scenes with a prosecutor spilling the beans to media to then get public uproar. And you mentioned the Google. Well, Michelle Dorber's husband was the ninth employee at Google, and he was accused, and she was accused in 2016 of manipulating social media for the recall of Judge Persky. So these are really important issues, I feel.
Okay, we've got some others with their hands up. I think we should see what they have to say. We've got Terry is next.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hmm? You hear me? All right. Yeah. So he said the films don't do much, but in the same token, look what Tim Ballard's doing right now with The Sound of Freedom. I belong to another group as well, Fights Against Sting Operations. I won't mention that name right now. I think most of us know who it is. But look what Tim Ballard's doing right now with The Sound of Freedom. He is absolutely influencing the public. And by you making this film and putting it out, I felt like that was also influencing the public to ridicule, scorn, demean sex offenders. I've been on the registry for almost 4.5 years now. That was called a sting operation. It should not have been sentenced the way I did. The sentencing was very, very harsh for everybody involved, especially me. I was the only one that got to prison out of 22 guys. But I kind of angered me that a little bit. I mean, I appreciate your passion and your drive to make a film, but I think the message is wrong, in my opinion. And tell me if I am, but it felt like another Tim Ballard movie is what it felt like, and empowering the public towards sex offenders even more is what it felt like to me. So, I mean, if I'm wrong, let me know. But that's just my statement.
Okay. Next, we have Tony. I'm going to unmute you, Tony.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, first of all, those two witnesses, they didn't, all they saw was some dry humping. They didn't see any type of penetration. They have no idea what happened before dry humping. Ms. Miller was, she was an alcoholic blackout where a person is able to function. They could even drive a car, but they don't recall what happened during the event. So there's no one can say that she didn't consent. And also this thing about the white privilege, Brock Turner got to Stanford because he worked for it. Everything was from hard work. Nothing was given to him. And also the term I keep hearing is behind the dumpster. It was near a wooden shed. It even says so in the transcript. And I think it was used to make the case sound sordid. This all came from Michelle Dauber. There's just so many things that were totally false that was thrown at the public. And of course, the gullible public fell for it. And then there was the prosecutor and all the misconduct. For example, she kept saying she was trying to conflate sexual assault with rape. So she said, like, count one is rape of an unconscious person. Well, there was no count rape of an unconscious person. It was sexual assault. And then she tried to, oh, she was making all kinds of things like that to confuse the jurors. So I don't think they, I think Turner got a bad, unfair trial, and I think he was wrongly convicted.
Well, you and I will disagree on that. I think it is sufficient evidence that he was on top of a half-naked, unconscious woman that two witnesses saw. And I think whoever's comment about a battle and not the war, I think it's a missed opportunity to have a more nuanced conversation about sentencing and punishment and the registry that we're missing.
Yeah. Can I go next? I'm just going to call on myself. Sorry, Chuck. I know I'm not the host. I can't, I mean, it seems like, I'm sorry to Brock Turner and his victim, like, or, one of them is right and one of them is wrong. And I don't really, it doesn't really matter to us, honestly, at this point, which one it was. What matters to us is the larger issue, which, you know, if we look at the things that we agree with Rebecca Richmond Cohen on and the things we disagree with, I mean, I like everything she's saying. And I don't know why we're alienating each other over the details of this tiny little case. And instead, letting her speak to us, she's saying all the things we want to hear. So she's an ally. And I would like to, I'd like to just acknowledge that. And I mean, honestly, she's winning, right? She's making movies, whether you like the movie or not. Anyone who sees that movie thinks that it was, you know, dumb what happened. So, you know, whether that was the exact right information for this case doesn't really matter. The fact is she's effective and we should be partnering with her and saying, yeah, let's do that again. And, you know, let's focus on something slightly different this time. And try to move the needle, because honestly, this is how we're going to win. We're going to win because our idea is the winning idea. Nobody deserves to be on this list. It's a stupid list. It's ineffective. It's a human rights problem. And it's very costly. We just need to all shout this from the rooftops. And I think she obviously knows how to play the system, because I played her movie, right? People everywhere were getting these links, and she's very good at marketing a movie. All right, I'm done. Thank you.
All right, should we go to the next question? Jim, you got your hand up. I'm going to unmute Jim. Hi, Jim.
I was just thinking, you know, doesn't a lot of people, or some people may think that this movie is promoting or encouraging longer sentences. He did definitely do wrong, but I'm thinking a lot of people would think that they're promoting and should be longer sentences, and judges may be fearful that the majority, you know, if they say think there's the people think they're soft on crime, that they could be fired, and a lot of the politicians feel the same way. You know, we don't want people to think we're soft on crime, so we're going to make harsher and more worse punishments for offenders, and. And what, then we'll make them happy, and then we'll, you know, get higher up on the totem pole or whatever. And I don't know if this movie is good. That you know, I think a lot of people might think, yeah, I get a harsher punishment. They deserve it. And the majority of people rule. And if they don't do what we tell them to do, they'll get fired. And I've seen the movie somewhat like that is my big concern. So that's it.
Okay. You have any comment, Rebecca, or you want me to get the next question?
You can get the next question.
All right. We've got Mike. Mike, I'm going to unmute you. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay. How you guys doing? It's not really a question. It's more of kind of an opinion from watching the movie. It just kind of came about from the previous gentleman's comment. You know, I think there's this interesting sort of juxtaposition where, you know, someone will watch this. Maybe they don't come from any sort of sex offender background or any sexual assault background. And they sort of watch this and they think, Jesus, this kid only got 6 months in jail or whatever. And then he's sort of out on his own. And then sort of the end of the documentary sort of tethered into sort of, oh, well, he's going to be a sex offender. And there wasn't a lot of, I don't want to say discussion about that, but, you know, registered sex offender is not a cakewalk. In fact, it's from my experience from the time that I was on it, was one of the most impactful, challenging, destructive points in my entire life. It's horrible. It requires a lot of your liberties to be given up and removed, and your whole walks of life are exposed to, you know, nationwide, globally. And so, like, I'm just saying that kind of the documentary didn't really touch base on that level of punishment that he was getting. It was kind of, I don't want to say it was directed solely that, oh, this kid got 6 months probation. He was a white kid from a great college and he got off on it or whatever. But you know, there is a definite up opposite end to being on a registry and being sort of in a prison within your own mind. You know, I definitely lived that life. It took me a long time to get off of the registry. I was actually, believe it or not, protected from the Adam Walsh Act. I wasn't supposed to be on the registry, but it is what it is. And I was put on it and I got myself off of it. It took a long time. But I can relate to everyone that is on the registry. I know the struggles. I know the pain. I know what it causes to your family, your friends, your neighbors, your employment, your job, everything. It takes a massive toll on it. And, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe there's another documentary that focuses more on the struggles that people on the registry go through. But that definitely is a sentence, if you will. It is a life sentence. Some states it's a 10-year sentence, it's a 15-year sentence. It's a lot of us can relate to. It was far worse being on the registry than being in any prison nationwide. So that's kind of what my two cents were. I saw it as kind of like this interesting juxtaposition, you know, between the actual sentence and the being on the registry part. It kind of seemed like, to summarize it again, it just seems like the nature of the film wasn't really portraying that this kid was still living a sentence that was going to be carrying on the rest of his life. And so I don't know where he is now. I don't know anything about the situation. I'm in Massachusetts. This was all the way out in the West Coast. So it's all news to me. But that's kind of what my two cents were.
All right, thank you. We have Brittany. All right, let's see if I can get you unmuted. All right, go ahead, Brittany.
I'm the wife of a sex offender who just got put into this whole situation. And I made a comment to my mother, who just happens to be in politics and has an opinion about everything, that the average is 3 years for a sex offender, and her jaw dropped to the floor like, that's not long enough, we need to fix that. And it's surprising how many people have that opinion. It's what can we do, I guess, is the question, to help them understand it's not bettering society if we are making nobody better in this situation. That's how can we do that? That's the thing that I really question with this whole situation I've come into. And I see a little bit of it with the video and stuff, but there, I would like, they don't see my side. I tried telling the judge, you are hurting me. You are hurting my child, but you don't care.
Thank you. Let me go up here to Gregory. Looks like you're in the next square. I'll unmute Gregory.
This is a question for Rebecca, the filmmaker. Did you have the role of the feminist movement in this is rather profound, and it's always something that I've kind of struggled with. I mean, I believe in pretty much all the tenets of the feminist cause, except for this. Did you have direct conversations with leading members of the feminist movements, for whatever that means, and bring this topic up? And what was their reaction? And I think that partnering with the feminist movement in this, I think is an important factor. And can this be done?
Yeah, thanks, Gregory. It's a great question. So the answer is the feminist movement isn't monolithic. There's lots of different feminisms. This is a critique of carceral feminism, of a mainstream, largely white feminism that aligns itself with police and prosecutors to seek what they see as justice. But there's many other forms of feminism, right? Abolition feminism doesn't do this. Black feminism questions state power in all these ways and always has. And these aren't new thoughts. You know, when these laws, the film we're working on right now is around mandatory arrests for domestic violence cases. A number of states, almost half the states, have laws on the books that say if there's probable cause for police to assume there's domestic violence, they need to make an arrest. What happens? There's a host of collateral consequences and many terrible things happen. It doesn't keep us safer. It leads to underreporting. And at the end of the day, survivors get arrested. Black feminists, Beth Ritchie, Mimi Kim, feminists of color have said this since the 70s, since the 80s. They were always saying that this was the thing that would happen. And they are ardent feminists. So I think it is about bringing to light this strand of feminism, of carceral feminism, of helping white carceral feminists see the effects that their policies have on other people, come to a reckoning that these tough on crime policies don't actually promote public safety or help victims. And, you know, I think there is no carceral feminist who would self-identify that way. That is the thing I find absolutely fascinating. Michelle Dauber, who led the recall campaign, very interestingly, one of the things that happened, the film cites the Ramirez case. Sorry, there's an echo, and I don't know if that's because you're unmuted, but I'm hearing myself echoed back, or if that's you, Chuck. But there's a case in which a Latino defendant got, 3 years, where Brock Turner got 6 months. The recall campaign tried to use this to say, like, oh, look how racist this judge is. When in fact, Persky wasn't even the judge who accepted the sentence, and they were different charges, because in the state of California at the time, Ramirez was convicted of assaulting a woman who was conscious, whereas Brock Turner, there were no mandatory minimums associated, or judges were allowed to depart from the minimum sentence if the defendant assaulted someone who was unconscious, which I think is wrong, right? I think it is wrong that we would punish one more harshly than the other. But we don't live in a world in which you'd bring down both sentences. We live in a world in which the prosecutors in that case walked to Sacramento and got overwhelming support for mandatory minimum law that Brock Turner, for the charge that Brock Turner was convicted of. And the reason I'm telling the story, and the reason I think it is fascinating, is that Michelle Dauber actually opposed the mandatory minimum. She knew that mandatory minimums increase the power of prosecutors and are used disproportionately against low income and people of color. And so she opposed it. But she could not see, and the recall movement could not see, that recalling this judge, that demanding a harsher sentence for Brock Turner would have the exact same effect. Right? I think Michelle Dauber does not see herself as a carceral feminist. And so what I hope these series of films do is call to light this thread in the feminist movement, and to ask for a reckoning within the movement, and to uplift the voices of Black intersectional abolitionist feminists who have been arguing for decades that these policies are failures.
Go ahead, Anne.
I was going to say that I think one of the most powerful messages we have which is just a tiny piece of all the messages. I mean, there's a thousand reasons to stop the registry, but I think a message that might get some hits is the idea that, you know, we give every teenager this device and we let them take it in their bedroom and close the door, and they all use it for porn. And so, you know, if I had a teenage daughter at this point, I would be freaking out with all the things that I know. I think that would be something you could do in 20 minutes, and it'd be really powerful information. And honestly, it's only fair that we warn people that the government is trying to wrap us all up on registries, not just for sex offenses. They're trying to wrap us up on registries for DUIs, for, you know, abusing our pets, for not paying our child support. I mean, they want to have registries everywhere. And I know this is not exactly our thing, but, you know, a 20-minute video about something like that, I think would be very effective at getting people to, because what we need to do is we need to convince everyone, you know, the powers that be terrified them with the, you know, Satanist daycare nonsense in the 80s. And then they scared them again in the 90s with the, you know, the disappearing children and the murders. And they've got the milk jugs, you know, telling us that, and then they've got the sex trafficking and pizza parlors. Like, we're in the middle of a sex panic, just like we have been other times. And it's hard to get unscared, right? Thank you.
Okay, Anna, a comment that I'd like to make is that I don't know if you're familiar, Rebecca, with the New York study titled Does a Watch Pot Boil? But it they looked at all of the arrests for a long period of time, hundreds of thousands of arrests for sexual crimes. And they found that over 95% of those arrests were of first-time offenders. And so, you know, even if everyone that's on the registry got a life sentence in prison forever, that wouldn't reduce the sex crimes, because over 95%, which is actually 95.6% of the crimes that people are arrested for are first-time sex offenses. And I think that would tie in good with what Anne just mentioned, that a lot of them are youth. I've heard that between a third and a fourth of the people on the registry were put there as 14 or 15-year-olds. And that seems like it's something that would make a good short film. And I just thought I'd raise that. Thanks.
I'm happy to put a link in the chat. We did make a short film about recidivism rates and how low they are for folks on the registry.
Okay. And the other film, the long film I forgot the title.
Untouchable.
Yeah, I have seen that myself. In fact, I've seen it two or three times. I've got Amazon Prime and it's on there. And I bought it on Amazon Prime. I think it's there on Amazon Prime for everyone now, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So, but is that something we could show on our on one of our Zoom meetings? Do we have to get special permission, or?
I think you're welcome to, as long as you're not charging admission. I think I don't actually know the answer to that, to be honest. But I don't know how it works to stream over Zoom.
Okay. And I know, I think War owns two DVDs of that, you know, that Vicky got back when it was, after it was made. But of course, I haven't seen those DVDs. But, you know, I mean, it seems like we could play one of those, just like we played your film, if the copyright owners of it are okay with us doing that. Maybe you're not part of the copyright owners of it.
Correct. I'm not. I'm not the copyright owner.
Who would we talk to, and how would we get that?
You can send me an email, and I'm happy to put you in touch with our distributors.
Okay. Thanks. Great. We've got a couple more hands up. Justin, go ahead, Justin.
Hi. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
All right. Awesome. Hello. Yeah. And thank you for all you do. I live in Virginia, and Virginia is definitely not a friendly state. It's definitely not a friendly state for sex offenders, definitely. I've already mentioned in the comments section, but I'm currently facing a charge on possession. It started off me seeking therapy, and as I was going through my intake, I was telling him what areas I needed to help in, and then the therapist just straight up reported to the authorities. So now I'm facing this thing here. And so just acts, due to a breach of a confidentiality. And so fast forward several months later, I actually got done with a test with this the sex forensic psychologist, and he was actually surprised when I told him that the confidentiality got breached, and he immediately went into the Code of Virginia on the website and pointed out to me that in order for the report to be substantiated, the victims, you have to have some, how do I say this? Sorry, it's a long day. The therapist, I didn't give the therapist a name. I didn't give the therapist any specifics of the victims that were in the pictures. That was before I knew that I should have just not to say anything to the police, but here I am now. And the therapist, I mean the forensic psychologist, told me that I could I'm eligible to sue if I like them, but I'm not sure if I have the the strength and endurance to do any more court stuff. But that's where I am now. It just shows how quick.
All right, I'm sorry to cut you off, Justin, but I just realized that we're over time, so we are not being respectful of our guest's time. But I would like her to have the last word since she was the guest. And we can maybe continue that last conversation later. Does that seem reasonable?
Yes.
Great. I don't have really last words. I just thank you guys for your time and good luck with the work you're doing.
All right. I would like to say a couple things. So we obviously got like kind of contentious there about the details of various cases. And I said it in the chat, but I'd just like to say it here that, you know, arguing down in the weeds doesn't elevate our issue. And I think Rebecca sounds like an ally in most every way. And I would like us to, you know, I'm sorry if anything got fussy, but we really appreciated your time. And we hope that you have all the success in your films. And we're sorry that we didn't know your other films. I love the idea that you have made a bunch of other short films, and I will 100% be reaching out to you to look at some of those, where maybe the weeds of the case won't distract us into a long conversation about legal procedure, which, you know, is admittedly its own separate thing, but I don't think it's quite as central to our issue. Anyway, thank you so much. I'm going to reach out to you, Rebecca, and we'll talk some more later. Thank you. It was great.
Good night, everyone.
Hey, Mike. I'm sorry that we started late. I'm new, so I don't really get to like, somebody always criticizes every of my decisions. So I'm doing my best. Oh no, you weren't the one who was mad about us starting late. Somebody else, some other Mike, I think, was mad about us starting late. Wasn't you. All right, bye everyone.
Bye.